Who should help shape the future of clean energy, land and water use, community health, and sustainable economic growth in the far north? Three Alaska women have been selected as Fulbright Arctic Initiative Scholars. And although they have very different career paths, they share the common goal of a healthy, secure Arctic, where the people who call this vast region home have a say in what that future looks like. We'll learn about their international research plans and what they hope will come out of it today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. 20 scholars from Canada, Denmark, Greenland, Finland, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, and the U.S. started 18 months of research in multiple areas of study in September. This is the fourth program for Fulbright Arctic Scholars. You may be familiar with the long-standing Fulbright program that sends students to numerous countries to study and learn about other cultures and ways of providing education. It's run by the U.S. State Department and sends people to more than 100 countries for study. The Fulbright Arctic Scholars Program focuses attention on Arctic nations, and our guests today can help us understand how they will apply their expertise to the research and policy recommendations that may come from their year and a half of international work. In the studio today is Penny Gage. Penny is the Managing Director of Launch Alaska. And on the phone with us today is Dr. Heather Sayuk Jean Gordon. She joins us by phone. Heather is the owner and principal consultant for Sayuk Solutions. And also in the studio today is Mariah Cedar. Mariah is a researcher at Tulane University and a special assistant to the Alaska Department of Family and Community Services. But Mariah is here today representing only her work, not the department. Welcome and thanks to you all for being with us today.
Excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, glad to have you on. Let's start with a background on your current work and kind of introduce you to Alaskans. And also just a little bit about why you decided to apply for the Fulbright Arctic Scholars Program. Penny, tell us about Launch Alaska and the connections you hope to make over the next year and a half.
Thanks for the invite to be here today. My name is Penny Gage. My Tlingit name is Kwasiya. I grew up in Southeast Alaska, but live in Anchorage currently, and I'm Managing Director at Launch Alaska. We are a nonprofit organization based here in Anchorage dedicated to accelerating Alaska's energy transition. And we do this primarily through working with startups. That is companies that are high growth in the sector of climate technology. So companies that want to help decarbonize different industries. And I applied to the Fulbright Arctic Initiative earlier this year. I had heard about it through other scholars who have participated in the past and brought back real policy solutions to Alaska. And I applied for the opportunity to go to another Arctic nation, in my case, Sweden, to learn about clean manufacturing over there and how we can bring that back to Alaska as we think about transitioning our communities and what new anchor tenants might be in to help develop renewable energy. I lead policy and advocacy work at Launch Alaska. So how can we bring new ideas to legislators, to policymakers, to community leaders from other Arctic nations that are similar to ours to help move forward the transition in a way that's equitable for all people?
Fantastic. Thanks for starting us off and that really clear illustration of your work at Launch Alaska. Heather, I want to turn to you now. Tell us about Sayuk Solutions and your focus on local control of resources for Indigenous populations.
Yeah, thank you again so much for having me. Sharon already introduced me. My name is Heather Sayuk Jean Gordon. My Inupiaq name is Sayuk, and it is the community Inupiaq drum. I work at Sayuk Solutions, which is my consulting organization. It allows me to respond directly to tribal and tribal nonprofit needs in Alaska. And so I partner with different tribes and communities in Alaska, as well as regions. And so I got interested in the Fulbright opportunity, like Penny, from someone else who did a Fulbright reaching out to me. Which is a fantastic way to learn and feel a little bit more comfortable and ask your questions. And so my work that I've been doing in Alaska, starting with the Nanilchik Village Tribe during my dissertation and kind of growing that work to South Central Alaska, has been around how to co-produce knowledge and engage Indigenous populations in leadership in managing land, water, and marine waters in Alaska. And so I applied to this program to be able to learn from what's happening in other nations in the Arctic. So I will be going to Sápmi, which is in northern Scandinavia. It's the lands traditionally of the Sami people across Norway, Finland, Sweden, and normally also in Russia. And I'll also be going to Nunavut for a short period of time, which is a territory in Canada where the Inuit people govern their own land management. So I'm curious in seeing how Sami people are engaging with the governments, the federal governments in the countries that they're living and moving across, and also learning how people in Nunavut are able to govern their own lands and waters and what processes they use, incorporating, you know, multiple ways of knowing and approaches to management.
We'll drill down more on those ideas that both you and Penny have presented as we move through the program. But Mariah, I want to turn to you. You're focused on health and community well-being. What are you hoping to learn and bring back to Alaska?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again for having us. And I'm in such an awe whenever I hear Heather and Penny's story. So allow me to share mine. My name's Mariah Cedar. I was born and raised in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm coming at this from the public health lens. My affiliation is with Tulane University as a researcher, but I'm also a doctoral student in the Doctor of Public Health program. So I'm really interested in understanding health, public health interventions to interpersonal violence. So that is my focus through the lens of mental health and well-being in the Arctic context. So for me, my exchange will be to Iceland to look at their interventions to interpersonal violence, because they are facing a lot of similar issues, a lot of similar makeup of Alaska when it comes to our statistics in the same areas of interpersonal violence and community health. So I'm just really interested in getting that Arctic context in another region, bring it back to Alaska to help inform either policy recommendations or service delivery or even future research out of Alaska.
And Mariah, staying with you, as you mentioned, you're going to Iceland for your research. And in an earlier interview, you mentioned that people from Denmark, Greenland, Iceland will be doing research in Alaska.
Yeah.
So will you all meet together after your research time to sort of discuss your findings before you write up a white paper or policy suggestions?
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate the question. So this program is really unique in that it is 18 months, but it is kind of a two-step process. We do have our exchange component. Then we also have our thematic theme groups that we convene over three sessions. So we just convened as a big group, and then we had time to work on our small groups, which is the mental health and well-being for me in Norway. So we'll meet again in Greenland in April or May, June, thank you. And then we'll meet again in DC at the very end of the program. So the intention of those meetups is to meet with the big group to see how everyone's doing, and then also dive into our work as a small thematic group to really flesh out these policy recommendations, what we're seeing in our own exchanges, and how we can really bring that together for the Arctic regions.
And your focus on community well-being and health, specifically on interpersonal violence, mm-hmm. I know that you're at the front end of this research track, but how does the work to lower rates of violence differ in Arctic communities from other places? Beyond remoteness and limited law enforcement, what else challenges this work that you're aware of?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. And that's something I hope to learn more as I go through this process. And what's really what drew me to this program to apply is I would have the opportunity to interact with different folks from different phases of their career in different regions to answer that exact question. Within my own thematic group, we have researchers, we have someone who's been all through the Arctic, someone with law enforcement background who's currently in the medical field. I bring myself a background in education and public health, like I said. So all of these kind of brains together thinking about these big questions that you've just posed is something that I'm hoping to further dive into throughout the rest of the program. So today, I don't have a neat answer for you, but hopefully we'll have a part two to this session.
Yes.
And get into that answer a little bit more.
Yeah, in a year and a half or so, we'll bring you all back and learn more about what you learned and what policy recommendations you'll have. Heather, turning to you, one of the first things you mentioned in a previous interview was wanting to show young people that this path exists. Talk about what you'd like to see in the future for Alaska Native participation in this Arctic Fulbright program.
Yes, that is a big reason I was hoping to come on today to share a little bit about this story and my story in this process. So I grew up in Homer, Alaska. It's a very small town at the tip of the Kenai Peninsula. Yes, we are on the road system. However, you know, I graduated in a small high school class, and I didn't really have the opportunity to see a lot of what was out there. I didn't really know at all about what university I should apply to. I didn't know where I should look in the world. I had no idea about how scholarships worked. And so this has been a road of learning where each step of the way, I try to share what I've learned so that other people can engage in this process and get to participate. And so I just want to share that the process to this is often when you read about it, it seems rather daunting and overwhelming and difficult. And it seemed that way to actually many of us on the program today, feeling that we didn't think we would qualify to apply. But, you know, with encouragement from other previous participants, we were all encouraged to apply. And so I think that's one of the biggest lessons that I want to share today is that, you know, if you don't apply, you'll never have that opportunity. But if you do want to, you know, reach out to others who have gotten to have that part as part of their path, you know, to be able to have a conversation and build that confidence to see where you can go.
And you mentioned this just briefly, that you've studied community well-being and sustainability in Nanilchik. What stands out from that work? What is the foundation for well-being for that community?
Yeah, so that, I mean, there were so many things we looked at when we did that project, but what really ended up coming out as lasting work and has been a lot of continued engagement with that community is the importance of subsistence. Subsistence foods, both as food security, Nanilchik is on the road system, but it's very remote and very expensive if you were to try and shop only at the grocery store. But it's not only food security. Subsistence or harvesting is a central part of Indigenous culture. And for that community especially, they feel their well-being is intricately tied to the ability to engage in this process and to pass their culture of how to harvest, how to process foods, how to share. And the great fear of, you know, having loss of subsistence would really make the community feel that they lose both their well-being and the ability to be a sustainable place to live.
And as your focus is on Indigenous land and water management, it's sort of a continuation of the work you've been doing with Nanilchik. It sounds like you'll be going to Nunavut. How does this community deal with land control issues? And what do you think that could inform for the future of land management in rural Alaska?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really, you know, I haven't gotten to dive into that yet. I'm hoping to do that trip in April. But, you know, so far, just seeing how that territory does manage what happens in that territory, which allows them to represent the interests of people that live there, as well as the needs, which also very revolve heavily around traditional foods and harvesting. And I think when I look at rural Alaska, rural and remote communities, especially off of the road system and often with small and very expensive grocery stores, that being able to really center the health and well-being of the biodiversity, the animal, plant, waters, all these populations that allow the animals that humans subsist on, the waters that we drink to remain healthy, is really critical. And being able to prioritize those needs is really central to Indigenous approaches to land and water management.
All right. Thank you. If you're just joining us, our guests today, this is Talk of Alaska, and our guests today are three Arctic Fulbright scholars. Penny Gage is the managing director for Launch Alaska. Dr. Heather Soyuk Jean Gordon is the owner and principal consultant for Soyuk Solutions. And Mariah Cedar is a researcher at Tulane University. Penny, you said that you'd heard about this program from another Alaskan Fulbright scholar who had success. Tell us about what you heard and how that affected your decision to decide to apply.
Well, the Fulbright program is pretty well known. Many people will recognize the name, if not know the specific programs. But this program, I think, is less known, the Fulbright Arctic Initiative. This is the fourth cohort, so it hasn't been going on that long. And speaking to what Heather was saying about feeling unqualified, probably 99% of those that were selected or have been selected for this program are PhDs or PhD candidates. I do not have a PhD, and I do not intend on getting one. I'm what's called a practitioner in this space, coming from the nonprofit sector and leading policy and advocacy. And so I was excited by looking at a former Fulbright scholar who had brought back real policy recommendations from Iceland, and her name is Gwen Holdeman, and she works up in Fairbanks for the university system. And she brought policymakers and legislators over to Iceland about a year ago to show them the transmission system and looking at the electrical grid there, and they brought back real policy solutions and ideas which were implemented in legislation that was passed this year and signed this summer by Governor Dunleavy. And that was a real inspiration. I am really eager to learn from European peers in clean energy and energy transition and what policies can be implemented at the local or national level, in the hopes that there's some things that we can bring back here to Alaska, or some learnings that we share with them about the journey that Alaska has as we approach this this new economic development. And yeah, I think the Fulbright program, it's funded by the State Department, by Congress, as you mentioned at the beginning. So its future, of course, always depends on appropriations. But for the next cycle, I would really encourage more quote-unquote practitioners like me to apply. You don't have to be a PhD candidate or have a doctoral degree to apply. And I think the Fulbright program is hoping to get more folks from many sectors and many backgrounds to contribute to these important groups that are creating policy recommendations that, as Mariah mentioned, we will be sharing in April 2026 in Washington, D.C.
And Penny, you're part of the Climate Change and Arctic Resources cohort. You talked a little bit about some of what you will be looking into, but do you think there's potential for manufacturing in the Arctic part of Alaska based on some of what you're starting to learn about the northern part of Sweden?
Yeah, again, I will mimic the answer of my colleagues that talked to me after I've done my exchange visit in 2025 and what I've found out. But so far from my application, I started researching what some call Sustainability Valley, a play on Silicon Valley in the United States, but they're calling it Sustainability Valley in the north of Sweden, Norway, and Finland, where there is abundant renewable energy through hydropower, not something we have in the north of our state, but also proximity to critical minerals and stable governance, which has led to some pretty interesting developments within clean manufacturing. And that includes some battery manufacturing facilities and also green steel manufacturing, which is steel made with renewable energy rather than coal energy, so significantly reducing the carbon footprint of something that has a pretty high greenhouse gas emission footprint. And I've been excited to see how these relatively small communities in the north of Sweden, Norway, Finland as well, are adapting to a large influx of workers, to large industry. Oftentimes, we talk about how Alaska has very high potential for renewable energy in our state, but we have such a small population, it's not always economic to develop those resources. And so having some large anchor tenants, manufacturing facilities that are using clean energy is a way to potentially develop these renewable energy resources and benefit the entire community. But I think there's a lot that can be learned for how indigenous communities are responding, what the effects are on local governments, on school districts, on infrastructure locally. And a lot is changing, even from when I submitted my application in the spring. the Inflation Reduction Act here in the United States has actually drawn a lot of investment back to the United States. And some of the projects that I was looking at in the north of Sweden and Norway are being put on pause as those companies are exploring battery projects in the United States. So it's a really dynamic sector. And as we want to help move Alaska forward on an energy transition path, its incentives and other policies are a really important part of that. So I'm looking forward to learning.
I remember many years ago, the late Senator Ted Stevens saying, why are all the call centers in India? Why can't we have call centers in the Arctic where people need jobs and we could put these places? It doesn't have to be in another country. The current governor, Governor Dunleavy, has talked about the potential for server farms in northern parts of the state where it's colder and you would need less energy. But still, all of these ideas about job creation and economic development in the Arctic require an energy source. And you mentioned the hydro potential in Sweden. We don't have that in the Arctic. But are you seeing some promise in the development of combinations of renewable and other sorts of energy as things advance that might open that door eventually to make it so that it could pencil out?
Yeah, I think we have vast renewable energy resources in Alaska across the state, whether that's offshore wind, geothermal, solar. It does work here in our state. It's already in practice. And you see in our over 200 isolated microgrids in the state, a lot of penetration of renewable energy already. And that is simply because the cost is really competitive with expensive diesel fuel, and it helps the community be more resilient and energy secure. And so I think there is a lot of potential. I'm not sure about data centers, or I mean, that's a large large use of energy. But there, do we have the renewable energy resources in Alaska? I think so. A lot of the startup companies that we work with at Launch Alaska are really excited about this development. But we have to think about the impacts of an influx of population, the influx of a new industry, what kind of industry we do want in our communities, and the trade-offs and benefits that a new industry would bring. And that's something they're looking at in the north of Scandinavia. A gigafactory was being constructed in Mo i Rana, Norway, which is above the Arctic Circle. Huge factory would require a lot of new employees and a huge development. I'm really excited to visit that factory. It's on hold right now, but I'm really excited to visit and learn from both the company, local government, about how that's going in the community and what that looks like, because it does change quite a bit the quality of life and the economy.
What type of factory would it be?
This is for battery manufacturing.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join our conversation today with three Alaskan Fulbright Arctic scholars that are with us today for Talk of Alaska. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 907-550-8422 is the local number in Anchorage. That's 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Mariah, your group is also working on suicide prevention. Are you seeing some ideas? I know it's early, but are you seeing ideas in other places that you have hope could be helpful here?
Yeah, absolutely. Excuse me. I think our group has a really unique lens. Again, we're all coming from different backgrounds. Not everyone's public health focused. And so what other folks have been bringing to the table, we just met again not too long ago for our in-person, where we really had these deep conversations about what would this look like for our group. And we're really thinking about honing into the communities that we want to help bring this forward to and working within community. So we're thinking about how can we relate to youth and connect them to this research as well. It's going to be about youth suicide prevention and programs surrounding that. So really, how can we meet them where they are and have them be a part of this process. Even though we're the Fulbright scholars, we can really bring them into this work as future scholars or also as future researchers or just folks bring things back to their community to strengthen that aspect of their community health. So I don't know yet, but we're still working that out, and we're really hoping for it to be community-based and driven.
Well, I think the idea of giving young people some agency over ideas for the future and taking some of that control in itself could be very helpful for them feeling like I can choose the better path for myself.
Absolutely.
And help my friends make those same decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with the Fulbright Arctic Scholars, Penny Gage, Dr. Heather Soyuk-Gordon, and Mariah Cedar, as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking with three Fulbright Arctic Scholars. Penny Gage is the Managing Director of Launch Alaska. Dr. Heather Soyuk-Gordon is the owner and principal consultant for Soyuk Solutions. And Mariah Cedar is a researcher with Tulane University. She's also a special assistant to the Alaska Department of Family and Community Services, but she is not speaking for the State Department today. She is speaking as an Arctic scholar. Mariah, you had mentioned in an earlier interview bringing some of what will be learned during your scholarship time to the Arctic Council. What do you see as the council's role in helping to bring forward some of what you three scholars may work on?
Yeah, sure. So for that question, the Arctic Council, for those not familiar, typically has a lot of work in the space of biodiversity, climate, ocean pollutants, emergencies, but healthy Arctic people is a component of that. So if we can bring forward anything that focuses on healthy communities, mental health and well-being, in our instance, suicide prevention, and layering in, thinking about the intersections of all the other focus areas that they have to bring forward any other additional policy recommendations or policy work, I think is something our group is really keen on doing to help propel and bring human health to these conversations that intersect with climate and clean energy and all the things that our Fulbright program is focusing on.
And again, recognizing that you're at the front end of all of this work, you had mentioned before that Iceland has interventions that we don't have in Alaska, at least not yet. Tell us about what you've learned about what's in place there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as I'm learning more, right, and my exchange hasn't happened quite yet, I'm hoping to go next summer. And what is really unique about our program, again, is that some scholars may be attached to an institution of learning, so university within their nation. I'm attaching myself to community-based organizations to learn firsthand from frontline workers, staff, people experiencing the services, how it's working and how it could be better, and what could we perhaps bring back to Alaska, but then also what works here in Alaska we could bring to Iceland as well and be good partners in that way to move this work forward.
Mm-hmm. All right, Heather, turning to you again, as you well know, Alaska has layered management of land, water, and subsistence resources, state, federal, tribal, other local governments. You talked some about the Inuit of Nunavut and their management of local resources, but drill down a little more there. What do you think can be learned from how much autonomy do they have, first of all, in their management? And how much do you think could be brought back to Alaska, especially given this complex system that we have in place now?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is definitely something I'm hoping to dive into more, but I would be happy to share some of what I've learned from the Nanilchik Village tribe and other tribes in Alaska, as well as the Lower 48. There's been some co-management processes that we have with tribes in the Lower 48 directly with the Department of Interior, while in Alaska we have co-management around specific animals such as migratory birds or polar bears or walrus that is not specific to working directly with a sovereign tribe. It's working with a group of Alaska Native individuals. And so seeing the government-to-government relationship that the federal government has with tribes, as well as the state recently signed that government-to-government recognition as well with tribes in Alaska. We're hoping that there's an Well, from what I'm researching and hoping to see is that inclusion of Indigenous people and Indigenous knowledges in these spaces, primarily because it gives more evidence. It gives us better information to make more informed decisions. And that's, you know, it's not really as much about a competition of knowledge. It's that there's been a lack of recognition of the value of it, Indigenous knowledge, or the need to, you know, having to confirm Indigenous knowledge. And so if we think of Indigenous knowledge holders as experts, just like we do a PhD in biology, if we think of Indigenous knowledge as expertise and evidence, just like we do work through biologists that are managing wildlife or plants or animals in Alaska, then we have a different way of approaching management. We have this really comprehensive understanding. We have a broader base of evidence that can help make more informed decisions. And additionally, what's unique about having that process in Nunavut is the ability to have different priorities. So if the priority is first on biodiversity to support human food security, as well as security of the globe within that biodiversity stance, then you have a very different approach than if priorities are centered around different modes of extraction that could potentially put food security or biodiversity, the safety and security of all life, at great risk. So that's my biggest thing that I'm trying to learn.
In an earlier interview, Heather, you mentioned resolutions that were passed during AFN, the Alaska Federation of Natives convention that just wrapped up over the weekend. I heard care given during the convention to clarifying and separating some language related to sovereignty and the relationship with the federal government, tribes, and Alaska Native corporations. You noted a resolution aimed at Indigenous land and water management. Talk about what you think this could look like in Alaska. You mentioned you were just talking about that in other places and some of the information you hope to bring back. But realistically, what do you think could get done here?
Well, yeah. So the recent work at the Alaska Federation of Natives just wrapped up this last weekend, and there were multiple resolutions that are put up for discussion and for voting ultimately, and they can be amended and changed. It's a very inclusive governance process. And so the one that I was specifically talking about is Resolution 2401, which was to reform existing laws and establish a native-led framework for fish and wildlife management. And the idea of this was about, you know, first bringing Indigenous knowledge into this space where it's largely lacking, depending on, you know, what agency you're working with, whether it's U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. There's so many organizations involved in land management and water management, and then I'm not even mentioning marine management through NOAA as well. And so this resolution was specifically to look at the role of Alaska Natives in co-management in subsistence, acknowledging that to manage subsistence, it also affects how you manage, you know, the waters and the lands that subsistence animals and plants live in. And the resolutions aren't necessarily saying that this is something that will happen. It's just something that can be promoted and advocated for, because now it's an understanding that the organizations that are a part of the Alaska Federation of Natives have agreed on this together. And the resolution actually goes through different federal laws. So the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the act that followed that, ANILCA, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and goes through what could be changed within those different laws that would allow this process to happen. Because it's not necessarily that Alaska Native people don't want to be involved. It's that there's very specific structure within federal Indian law, case law, statutes, historic treaties that actually prevent Indigenous communities and tribes from being actively engaged in these processes. So the resolution really breaks down what are the specific changes that would have to happen to be able to equitably involve Alaska Native tribes and people in this work.
Thank you for really clarifying that. And, you know, it is, there are so many layers, as you know, and figuring out entry points for more Indigenous inclusion. I think those resolutions are aimed at that very direction and clarifying that need and desire by Indigenous Alaskans. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Carl is in Homer. Hello, Carl.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It was wonderful to hear Launch of Alaska talk about manufacturing in Northern Europe, especially Sweden. And the Swedish steel, which is just magnificent steel for boat building, as well as in Iceland, they manufacture a lot of aluminum with their geothermal heat. And my goal in Alaska, especially down here in Homer, is to improve our manufacturing and our boat building. And is there a possibility of getting transportation from Northern Europe to Alaska across the Northwest Passage with Swedish steel and Icelandic aluminum? And to combine that with maybe some Finnish tractors for forestry. They're leaders in the world in forestry tractors that haven't even made its footprint in Alaska yet with their light harvesting. And I'll get off the air and listen to this great program. Thank you, Launch of Alaska. This is fantastic.
Thanks for the call, Carl. A very excited Alaskan about the prospect of maybe importing some of this the materials that are being created by greener technology, greener energy into Alaska. I don't imagine that any of you have answers about how that might work, but what are your thoughts about Carl's comments?
Yeah, thank you. That does sound exciting. You know, I get to work with startup companies that work on these sectors and much more. And the reason I'm in this work is because I'm inspired by these new ideas and these new dreams, and whether that's an electric outboard motor for a boat or geothermal energy that doesn't require deep drilling or software programs that help utilities better dispatch renewable energy. So I love this idea of having a boat caravan coming over from the north over to Alaska. And I think what you're touching on, too, I wasn't familiar with Finnish tractors. I will set to Google and check them out. But the industrial sector is a large emitter of greenhouse gas emissions in Alaska and globally. And so decarbonizing how we are creating aluminum, steel is a big part of that. So using clean energy rather than coal or fossil-based energy to create those is really important. And I think the caller touched on the future of that. And we can be looking to our Scandinavian neighbors to see how they're moving that forward. The Swedish steel, green steel company is called Stegra, formerly H2 Green Steel, and they're just doing amazing work in this space.
It's exciting to hear about these innovations. In Alaska, we know there's an organization called Grizzly Wood Products or Grizzly Products. I might have the name wrong,
maybe, but Plastic Solutions.
Something with Grizzly in the name, and it's making out of recycled plastic, making lumber out of recycled plastic, which is such a great idea and a great reusing of something that would otherwise be a detriment. So these innovations are important for the future. As you think about them, though, Penny, when you think about balancing the environmental concerns in fragile Arctic environments with the need for mining for critical minerals, because batteries are kind of the way, a big part of the way of the future for renewable energy and storage and evening out delivery of that. How do you think about that need for critical minerals, mining, and the future of cleaner energy production, kind of balancing those things, especially in the fragile Arctic?
Yeah, the United States, similar to Europe, is increasingly looking to source critical minerals more domestically rather than importing from Africa or China markets where labor standards and environmental standards are not as high. And so it's something that we are increasingly, our national government is increasingly thinking about and looking to a place like Alaska that has a lot of mineral deposits. And critical minerals are defined by the Secretary of Energy and the Secretary of Interior as being at high risk of supply chain disruption and also serving an essential function in one or more energy technologies, including energy storage. I mean, look at the phones we all have in our pockets that are made with batteries. That's also used in an electric vehicle. So aluminum, cobalt, copper, lithium, those are some examples. And some of those we have here in Alaska and they have in the north of Europe as well. So I think there's some lessons that can be learned. The region I'd like to study is some call the Nordic Battery Belt because there's a lot of battery manufacturing happening in the north in proximity to these critical minerals. But it's in a similarly extreme and remote environment. And spurred by domestic demand, Inflation Reduction Act incentives, our state is figuring out how we're going to develop these resources in an economic and responsible way that doesn't replicate past energy extraction paradigms and empowers local residents. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer here, but I'm really curious to learn from the Nordic Battery Belt and similar large-scale clean tech development in that region about how they're moving forward with this.
Yeah, thank you for that. We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the way forward for the Arctic, its resources and people as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Ethel is in Soldotna. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for this this program. I really appreciate the depth and scope of the subjects that you find to cover. My question was directly related to the interests and the backgrounds of the Fulbright scholars, because I was trained I'm a lawyer, right? I'm an appellate attorney. I'm also bilingual. I grew up in the Arctic doing all the good old buddy fishing gory stuff. But I'm always curious about the ability of our people to maintain their cultural perspectives even as we're navigating and taking advantage of things like the Fulbright program, and how each of these individuals has had to adapt to that kind of mindset and trying to figure out, okay, whose perspective am I on in my approach to this aspect of my project or to my end goals? And so that's why I called in. I'm just really curious.
Oh, Ethel, I love that idea of, whose outcome is this? Is it being pushed by the Fulbright program, or is it really up to the scholars themselves? So what are there mandates? Are there requirements that you have to do something in a certain way or produce something? Or is it more, here is this time for you to develop your own ideas, your own policy suggestions? As Ethel is asking, who's really helping to shape what the outcome will be? Who wants to take that?
I could speak generally to some of the requirements, and I'm sure Heather would have something great to say here. We are given a stipend through this Fulbright program, which is to fund our individual exchange visit and our living expenses while we go to another country for 6 weeks to 3 months, and we can bring our families with us. I'm bringing my husband and two kids. Mariah's bringing her husband and her three children. So there's a cultural exchange component as well to the program. And then they require group work, as we've been mentioning, with other Fulbright scholars, and then the individual products. So policy recommendations are required to come out, a manuscript, a white paper as well, a poster session we'll have in Washington, D.C. in April 2026 to show to policymakers and others the results of our individual exchange. But it's pretty open-ended as far as what results we come forward with and our ideas, in my view. But I think Ethel's touching on something really interesting where, coming from especially diverse backgrounds, as I think the three of us do, how you maintain your perspective and your your center, perhaps, and your views as you are participating in some of these more traditional institutions. And that's a really interesting one that I can just feel Heather wanting to jump in, even though I can't see her.
Heather, what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, thanks, Penny, for giving the first overview. And thank you so much for that question. So the main thing, as she said, is the group work. That's the main, that's the only thing super required, is that we produce those policy briefs, the white paper, the group work together. For our individual work, it's more of your own path of learning. It's a pretty short timeline to be able to produce products, especially when people sometimes have their exchange, you know, at the end of 2025, and then the funding wraps up in 2026. So I'll say for me personally, I'm using this as a learning experience, as a way to bring what I learned from Sami people and from Inuit people in Canada back to Alaska to share with other Indigenous people and to share with policymakers. I do hope to develop some products from my personal research as well, but I think it'll just take a little bit longer than the Fulbright program itself, since it's, again, a short period of time. And when I think of managing the various interests, recognizing that it's a State Department funded program, I don't feel like personally I haven't felt pressure from the State Department, you know, to that I have to represent current existing U.S. policy on land management. That's the program is really about education and learning and bringing new perspectives that could enhance how the U.S. is doing things. What can we learn from? How can diplomacy be useful in this way? And so I feel very open to being able to exchange to the places I go as well what I've learned from Alaska and to create that dialogue. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And I want to turn to an email question that we had here. Austin in Nome writes, "The Port of Nome development has destroyed Alaska Native people, place, and history, and is having cascading effects on the coastline as a result of coastal erosion. More importantly, threatens to destroy the integrity of the northern Bering Sea. Consequently, cultural practices are being impacted severely by increased commercial shipping, militarization, and socioeconomic change. We Alaska Natives have a right to say no to development. What are the interconnections between environmental health and cultural integrity that can be elevated to stop development like the Port of Nome?" I imagine that through the next several months, you will hear from other Indigenous people about projects that they don't want to see go forward. And as we know, a lot of these projects will go forward in some fashion or another. So what are your thoughts about how to incorporate these concerns, and if projects are not going to be stopped, to make sure that they happen in the best possible way for all the people who live in these environments? Heather, do you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, sure. So 100%, thank you for that question. Definitely what I've been talking about is centralizing Indigenous interests of food security, of cultural needs, of that cultural continuity that is so central to well-being. I think it's important to remember that it is so important that people have that culture, that well-being, that food security, to be able to live where they choose to live. And that there's a lot of research shown where when these things are taken away, there's a lot of trauma and there's a lot of ill-being or unhealthiness that ends up impacting people for very long-term, intergenerational. And so I really thank that for being brought up. I also have been doing some work in the Bering Strait, trying to get funding to do a marine spatial planning project from Indigenous perspectives. I think that's really central to understand, you know, a lot of times there may be environmental studies or there may be research on should we or should we not go forward with a development. And that might involve Indigenous people at the last minute of the 12th hour before the decision is made. And it often is not involving true consultation and meaningful engagement that allows true sharing of how things will impact people. And so I think that is absolutely critical. Additionally, you know, as people do share, there's often a lot of difficulty in the way that Indigenous people, the way we talk, which is through story and through metaphor and relating things to our lives. And sometimes that doesn't communicate super well with policy and decision makers. And I think learning about how to co-produce knowledge and two-way exchange of knowledge, even within Alaska itself, we really have different ways of communicating and living and what we value. And I think that's really critical.
Well, thank you for that. Penny, you want to pick it up there?
Oh, I was going to mention, we were all together, all 20 Fulbright scholars were together in the north of Norway at the beginning of September for an orientation week where we all got to know each other and meet the leads of the Fulbright program. And we toured around several communities in Sami territory, the indigenous people of the north of that region, and met with the president of the Sami parliament and heard about their challenges with wind turbine development in their region that interferes with reindeer herding and their territory, and very similar issues to what we see in Alaska, a government far away making decisions that impact things on the ground and don't have answers here, but just an example of some of the learnings that we are all seeing firsthand and bringing to this research and to these lessons. And it was an amazing learning experience. That was not an issue I had been aware of prior to that visit.
And do you all think that part of the aim of this particular track for Fulbright, that it's aimed at the Arctic and bringing people into Arctic nations and communities to better understand these issues, do you think all of this will also help from this perspective of Indigenous voices saying, hey, remember that we live here and have for thousands of years and need to have a say in what the future looks like? Do you think that this program is sort of has that as one of its intentions?
I think so. And I'm really heartened by the fact that there are several Indigenous scholars as part of this cohort. We have several from Greenland and Canada and Alaska, as we've noted, and I'm probably forgetting others. I don't have the bios in front of me for all 20 right now, but I think that number has gone up over time, and you're seeing more Indigenous researchers who are being attracted to this program, hearing about it, and bringing their research findings to the highest levels in Washington, D.C., or the Arctic Council.
And so in just a few seconds here, the time we have left, Mariah, what's next? What's on your horizon immediately with this scholarship?
Absolutely. So what's next for me is meeting with my thematic group. So we have monthly calls where we all from across the Arctic talk about our topic, which is youth suicide prevention and what that's really going to look like at the end of these 18 months. And we're looking forward to meeting again in June. And then my exchange is shortly after. So I'm hoping to really think about suicide prevention and interpersonal violence interventions in the Arctic.
Penny? What's next immediately?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Some webinars with our group and prepping to be abroad in Sweden for a couple months next fall with my family. So the logistics of housing and childcare really is what I'm thinking about.
Very exciting. And Heather, close us out here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm in the security group, which has met some challenges as some people have very traditional, you know, maybe military security or border security, while I'm looking at food security. So we're definitely in a diplomatic negotiation right now of how to talk about security and what that means in the Arctic.
Okay, thank you so much to our guests today, Penny Gage, Dr. Heather Gordon, and Mariah Cedar. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Joseph Hansen helped us out today. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.